4. 14 notable nonfiction Stephen King works. There is no way to adequately cover all of King's nonfiction in a forum such as this book. King's nonfiction comprises a body of work that deserves its own thoughtful book-length coverage. However, there are some works that we can look at here, particularly a few books and essays that are King at his most iconic, creative, and entertaining. King's Garbage Truck, February 1969, May 1970. Danse Macabre, 1981. Nightmares in the Sky, 1988. Midlife Confidential, The Rock Bottom Remainders Tour America with Three Chords and an Attitude, 1994. My Little Serrated Security Blanket, Outside, December 1995. Secret Windows, 2000. On Writing, 2000. Faithful, 2004. Stephen King's Letter to His Younger Self, 2010. What Ails the Short Story, The New York Times, September 30th, 2007. Raymond Carver's Life and Stories, The New York Times, November 19th, 2009. Guns, 2013. Just a Little Talent, Hard Listening, The Greatest Rock Band Ever of Authors Tells All, 2013. Hearts in Suspension, 2016. King's Garbage Truck, 1969 to 1970. King's Garbage Truck is a collection of 47 columns of commentary, reviews, and critique totaling approximately 35,000 words, which King wrote for the University of Maine student newspaper, The Maine Campus. Detailed synopsis of all 47 columns appear in my book, The Lost Work of Stephen King. A new edition of the original Lost Work will be published by the Overlook Connection Press, the publisher of the limited edition of Stephen King, American Master. I am currently working on Volume 2 of The Lost Work of Stephen King. To give a sense of what King wrote about, here are the first lines and word count of all 47 columns. 1. February 20th, 1969, 642 words. The Goddard College dancers, seven students from a small liberal arts school in Vermont, put on a program called Why We Dance last Sunday night in Hawk Auditorium. 2. February 27th, 1969, 515 words. You have to feel sorry for William Shakespeare. 3. March 6th, 1969, 515 words. If you watch TV at all lately, you've probably noticed a new trend in entertainment, the cheapy game show. 4. March 13th, 1969, 690 words. There's a plot afoot. 5. March 20th, 1969, 670 words. I am soliciting. 6. March 27th, 1969, 600 words. This was a pretty good week. Number 7. April 10th, 1969, 580 words. You say it's been a bad week? Number 8. April 17th, 1969, 740 words. I was in Fun City this weekend for the first time in 4 years, and it's a strange scene for a country boy who grew up in a small Maine town where there are more graveyards than people. Number 9. April 24th, 1969, 690 words. As president emeritus of this, several words obscured and illegible, nitty-gritty uptight society for a campus with more cools, which we lovingly refer to as the NGUTSCMC, pronounced Nagutsmic, for all you linguists out there, I have the happy duty of announcing that we have decided to call a general student strike next week. Number 10. May 1st, 1969, 600 words. SS-1 was the course number for the first special seminar taught here at Maine during the 68 fall semester. Number 11. May 8th, 1969, 914 words. Want me to tell you a bad thing? Number 12. May 15th, 1969, 715 words. Ugly. Number 13. May 22nd, 1969, 780 words. I've always been fond of cliches, and one of my favorites is, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. Number 14. June 12th, 1969, 518 words. Boom! And all at once, it's summer. Number 15. June 20th, 1969, 528 words. People have been telling me for years that I've got a sympathetic face. Number 16, June 27th, 1969, 878 words. It's summer, and you're hot. Number 17, July 4th, 1969, 790 words. I was thumbing through a stack of old records last week at the home of a girl who has graduated from Bobby Rydell and Chewing Gum to Jethro Tull and Terrytons. Number 18, July 11th, 1969, 1,000 words. The man's name is Neil Armstrong. Number 19, July 18th, 1969, 880 words. The time has come, folks, the day you've all been waiting for. Today is the day we give out the coveted Gritty Awards. Number 20, July 25th, 1969, 950 words. The university's annual freshman orientation program, the Amiable Orgy of Tourism, lectures, scheduling, and general all-around rubbernecking, has been in full swing now for the last 6 weeks or so, and the casual observer hardly knows whether to be amused, skeptical, or envious. Number 21, August 1st, 1969, 790 words. I think that of all the people on earth that I would most not want to be, the one who would cop the prize would be Pope Paul. Number 22, August 8th, 1969, 930 words. Last weekend, I spent about an hour leafing through some back issues of The Campus, glancing at some of the stuff I'd written for the garbage truck over the last 5 or 6 months. Number 23, September 18th, 1969, 780 words. And here we all are again, in our places with bright, shiny faces. Number 24, September 25th, 1969, reprint of column number 21. 25, October 3rd, 1969, 550 words. A funny thing happened to me on my way to class a couple of days ago. Number 26, October 9th, 1969, 750 words. By now you've probably read at least a dozen reviews of Easy Rider, the new Peter Fonda movie. Number 27, October 16th, 1969, 680 words. It has been suggested to me by a lot of people, from Chancellor McNeil, from faculty members, from student senators, and from the general run of the student body, that this is a pretty apathetic campus. Number 28, October 23rd, 1969, 684 words. Well, a part of me went into hibernation last week. Number 29, October 30th, 1969, 990 words. Friends and neighbors, we here at the nitty-gritty uptight society for a campus with more cools, Nagutsmik, you all remember us, right? Are starting to get a little worried. Number 30, November 6, 1969, 782 words. In the short course of this year, I've already managed to alienate the main freshmen and the organized flabs on campus, owls, eagles, etc. Now I'm going to see if I can alienate the rest of you by picking what I consider were the best singles and albums of the year, and the worst. Number 31, November 13, 1969, 818 words. The subject this week is cops. Number 32, December 4th, 1969, 770 words. It's a little bit frightening to wake up in the middle of the night and realize that you may be the only one on earth that realizes why the world is in so much trouble. Number 33, December 11th, 1969, 590 words. Okay, folks, because absolutely nobody asked for it, here it is. Number 34, December 18th, 1969, 884 words. There are strange things in the world. Number 35, January 8th, 1970, 794 words. So, there are your 60s. Number 36, January 15th, 1970, 805 words. I, Stephen Edwin King, being of sound mind and body, 22 years of age, and thus past the age of my majority, having no debts outstanding, never having been convicted of felony or misdemeanor, a resident of Durham, Maine, and freeholder in that town, registered voter, male, and of the Caucasian race, do hereby make this my last will and testament, revoking all other wills and codicils. Number 37, February 5th, 1970, 762 words. The subject this week, my friends, is the boob tube. Number 38, February 12th, 1970, 676 words. If you're a conservative and a Bangor Daily News reader, or even if you're not, gather round. Number 39, February 19th, 1970, 649 words. Flowers this week for MUAB, the Memorial Union Activities Board. Number 40, February 26th, 1970, 532 words. 2 years ago, an excellent actor by the name of George Kennedy won an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor in a Paul Newman movie called Cool Hand Luke. What we have here is a failure to communicate. Number 41, March 19th, 1970, 687 words. The other day, I came across a letter I wrote last February 26th, which was the day of the big snowstorm of 69. Number 42, March 26th, 1970, 889 words. I've been student teaching for the last 8 weeks, and I've been out of touch. Number 43, April 9th, 1970, 515 words. Have you ever thought how exciting some of those boring TV shows would be with a few campus personalities to liven them up? Number 44, April 16th, 1970, 787 words. Last year in May, Dick Meland and I were handing out flyers in the Memorial Union just prior to the Rally for Free Speech. That rally, you may remember, followed the march to end the war when eggs and other objects were thrown. Number 45, April 30th, 1970, 717 words. Well, folks, it looks like that season again. Number 46, May 7th, 1970, 957 words. Well, this is almost it. The garbage truck is almost out of gas. Number 47, May 21st, 1970, 486 words. A blessed, question mark, event announced to the University of Maine at Orono. The last line of Stephen King's final main campus garbage truck column was, "Take care of yourselves, friends." Danse Macabre, 1981. Danse Macabre was King's 1981 masterful nonfiction overview of the horror genre. The book was suggested to him by his editor Bill Thompson, who thought it would prevent King having to answer repeated questions about his thoughts on horror. In the forenote to Danse Macabre, King wrote, "If you want to know what I think about horror, there's this book I wrote on the subject. Read that. It's my final statement on the clockwork of the horror tale." Danse Macabre is the book in which King first stated his theory about there being three levels of horror. He would first try to terrify the reader, he would then try to horrify the reader, and then he would go for the gross-out. In a June 1983 interview in Playboy magazine, King expounded on his triumvirate of horror aesthetic. The genre exists on three basic levels, separate but interdependent, and each one a little bit cruder than the one before. There's terror on top, the finest emotion any writer can induce. Then horror, and on the very lowest level of all, the gag instinct of revulsion. Naturally, I'll try to terrify you first, and if that doesn't work, I'll try to horrify you. And if I can't make it there, I'll try to gross you out. I'm not proud. I'll give you a sandwich squirming with bugs or shove your hand into the maggot-churning innards of a long-dead woodchuck. The woodchuck King is referring to appears in 1979's The Dead Zone, in the scene where Johnny Smith touches Dr. Brown's hand. He found himself remembering a picnic in the country when he had been 7 or 8, sitting down and putting his hand in something warm and slippery. He had looked around and seen that he had put his hands into the maggoty remains of a woodchuck that had lain under the laurel bush all that hot August. He had screamed then, and he felt a little bit like screaming now. It has been close to 40 years since King wrote the Danse Macabre. An update would be welcome, and King did write an essay as the forenote for the 2010 edition called What's Scary, in which he looked at horror cinema from 1999 through 2009. But as is often the case with long passages of time and books that end at a particular year in coverage, the work to research and write about a topic as broad and deep as the horror genre is overwhelming and clearly not something King wishes to tackle. Nightmares in the Sky, 1988. Nightmares in the Sky is a coffee table book of photographs by F. Stop Fitzgerald of architectural gargoyles, those stone monster demons that peer down on us from apartments, office buildings, churches, libraries, museums, courthouses, and other stone structures. King wrote an introductory essay. In his essay, he wrote, "Coffee table book or not, I would suggest a coffee table might be the worst place for this particular tome. Coffee tables, after all, are low pieces of furniture accessible to children, and I am as serious as I can be when I say that this is no more a book for children than George Romero's The Night of the Living Dead is a movie for them." In his essay, King leads us to the question, why have these faces been deliberately added to the facades and roofs of buildings for so many centuries? Their function is to act as a drain for rainwater, but if form does dictate function, then all that would be necessary would be a pipe. Instead, we have grotesque faces serving this purpose. Granted, some gargoyles are cherubic angels, but most seem to be these leering, silently shrieking, often insane faces growing out of buildings like, as King aptly describes, a tumor. And that leads King into a discussion of the symbolic meaning of architectural gargoyles over the ages, thereby achieving what the best art can do, provide a context that opens up the subject and, hopefully, enlightens. In Section 8 of his essay, King writes, "How is this particular effect, which changes in its specifics but seems to maintain a constant emotional key chord of fear, even horror, achieved?" In the January 1971 issue of Onan, a University of Maine student literary magazine, 24-year-old Stephen King published an untitled poem that had as its first line, "In the key chords of dawn." F. Stop Fitzgerald's website tells us, "His book collaboration with horror writer Stephen King, Nightmares in the Sky, sold over 180,000 copies and was a national bestseller." Midlife Confidential, The Rock Bottom Remainders Tour America with Three Chords and an Attitude, 1994. This book chronicles the travels of the Rock Bottom Remainders, Stephen King's band. At the time the book was released, the band consisted of Dave Barry, Tad Bartimus, Roy Blunt Jr., Michael Douris, Robert Fulghum, Kathy Kamen Goldmark, Matt Groening, Josh Kelly, Barbara Kingsolver, Al Cooper, Greil Marcus, Dave Marsh, Ridley Pearson, Jerry Peterson, Joel Selvin, Amy Tan, and Jimmy Vivino. King's contribution to the text was the essay, The Neighborhood of the Beast. Tabitha King's contribution, she was the tour photographer, was an essay called, I Didn't Get Paid Enough, in which she wrote, "No doubt there are morons out there demanding to know if I don't have enough money. Well, would you work for diddly shit? No, you wouldn't. Just what I thought. Probably, if you had enough money, you wouldn't work at all. So who's got the work ethic here? I have enough money. There's a difference between having enough money and getting paid enough to compensate for the work. I knew you'd understand." In The Neighborhood of the Beast, King notices the graffiti on the toilet stall walls, wherein he sits and also recounts pithy graffiti of the past he couldn't help but remember, such as, "Dogs fuck the Pope, no fault of mine," and "Save Russian Jews, collect valuable prizes." King would revisit bathroom graffiti in the story, "All That You Love Will Be Carried Away." Speaking of graffiti, the title of King's essay, The Neighborhood of the Beast, refers to something King saw written on the back of the bathroom door precisely at his eye level. 664/668, The Neighborhood of the Beast. What number sits precisely between 664 and 668? The ominous number 666, of course, the biblical sign of the beast, a.k.a. Satan. What that says about being on a tour bus with a bunch of middle-aged rockers is left to the reader's interpretation. Rock Bottom Remainder's musical director Al Cooper considered the Rock Bottom Remainder's tour the nadir of Western civilization. My Little Serrated Security Blanket, Outside, 1995. My Little Serrated Security Blanket was written for Outside magazine and appeared in their December 1995 issue. The introductory tagline to the article read, "The blacksmith of horror rejoices in the potentialities of an ice axe." This brief nonfiction essay, around 500 words, is Stephen King having a great deal of fun in a very well-written piece. He is imagining the kind of damage an ice axe could do to the human body, even though he admits that he tries not to think of murder when he looks at the DMM predator. King tells us that the holes the business end of an axe could make in a human body would be lozenge-shaped. King pinpoints the specific areas he would apply the axe to: the gut, throat, forehead, nape of the neck, and orbit of the eyeball. And he even knows how far he would put it in, to the 11th serration. In a hilarious instance of bizarre synchronicity, the same issue of Outside that published King's grisly ode to ice climbing mayhem also included the quite perky tribute to top-of-the-line first aid kits by none other than our national doyenne of the glue gun, Martha Stewart. Secret Windows, Essays and Fiction on the Craft of Writing, 2000. Introduction by Peter Straub. This essay was published for the first time in Secret Windows. Peter Straub is a longtime friend of Stephen King, as well as his co-author on The Talisman and Black House. There is also talk of a third co-authored volume. Straub opens this introduction with what King calls in the same volume a great hooker. Let us deal with a potential embarrassment, or what may seem at least a conflict of interest, right away. In this companion book to On Writing, my name pops up often enough to suggest that Stephen King may have adopted the remuneration system perfected by the late Pee Wee Marquette, a diminutive, klaxon-voiced gentleman long ago employed by a jazz club called Birdland to announce the names of the musicians on stage, and who gleefully performed this function as long as the musicians in question slipped him a couple of bucks. Dave's Rag, 1959-1960. Dave's Rag was a weekly newspaper written, published, and sold by Stephen King and David King. Jumper. Jumper was written in 1959, when King was 12, and Part 1 was published in the December 29, 1959 issue of Dave's Rag. The publication dates of Parts 2 and 3 are not known, although it is a safe bet they appeared sometime in 1960. Jumper is the story of Jeff Davis, a police counselor who, throughout his career, has had to repeatedly convince Robert Steps not to commit suicide by jumping off high buildings. The story involves some close calls and a giant metal hook. Rush Call. Rush Call was written in 1959 when King was 12, and Part 1 was published in a 1960 issue of Dave's Rag. Rush Call is a Christmas story about a Scrooge-like character named Dr. Thorpe. One Christmas Eve, he gets a rush call to an emergency, a car crash in which a boy with acute appendicitis is trapped. Dr. Thorpe is asked to operate on the boy in the car to remove his appendix, which he does successfully. This was an apparent transcendent experience for him, and walking home later that Christmas day, he discovers he understands the true meaning of Christmas. The story ends with the beginning instead of the end. The Horror Market Writer and the Ten Bears, a true story. This first appeared in the November 11, 1973 issue of Writer's Digest magazine. This is a terrific essay in which King lists his top 10 fears. 1. Fear of the dark. 2. Fear of squishy things. 3. Fear of deformity. 4. Fear of snakes. 5. Fear of rats. 6. Fear of closed-in places. 7. Fear of insects, especially spiders, flies, beetles. 8. Fear of death. 9. Fear of others, paranoia. 10. Fear for someone else. This list holds up, wouldn't you agree? Forward to Night Shift. This forward, written in February 1977, first appeared in the 1978 Night Shift short story collection. This is the essay in which King uses the metaphor, the shape of a body under a sheet, a variant of which I borrowed to use as the title of the limited edition of my complete Stephen King encyclopedia, which was originally called The Shape Under the Sheet. This is a fine tutorial on writing, as well as an insightful deep dive look at fear, which, King tells us, makes us blind. As in many forwards, the concluding section of this is an acknowledgement section. King thanks his wife Tabitha, his kids, his early editors, including Bill Thompson, and the editors who bought many of the stories in the collection. On becoming a brand name. This first appeared in the February 1980 issue of Adelina magazine. This long essay was Stephen King's musing on the fact that he was now a brand. He discussed the fact that Stephen King was now a brand name for horror. On becoming a brand name is very autobiographical, and in it, King recounts his efforts to become a successful writer, beginning with his earliest short stories sold to magazines like Cavalier, and moving through his early successes with Carrie, Salem's Lot, and The Shining, his first bestseller. Horror Fiction. This was an excerpt from King's 1981 nonfiction history of the horror genre, Danse Macabre. An Evening at the Billerica Library. This is a transcript of a very interesting and engaging lecture King gave at the Billerica Library in Massachusetts on Friday, April 22, 1983. His requested fee was a place to bunk and a six-pack. King talks about the nature of fame and says it always surprises him when people ask him, "How does it feel to be famous?" Because he states, "I'm not." He recounts the story of his wife Tabitha asking their six-year-old son, Owen, "Owen, do you know where Daddy's going?" Owen's reply, "Yes, he's going off to be Stephen King." King tells the story of a fry cook asking him if he was Francis Ford Coppola. King said he was and signed an autograph for the guy as Francis Ford Coppola. "That was bad," he said. "God always gets you for that." King has long been attributed as the author of the statement, "I have the heart of a small boy. I keep it in the jar on my desk." In this speech, he correctly attributes the quote to Robert Bloch, who was the one who actually said it first. In this lecture, King says that the genesis of his story, Here There Be Tigers, was his son, Owen, admitting to him that he got embarrassed when he had to go to the bathroom in school because they had to raise their hand to ask to go and everyone knew he had to go pee-pee. This lecture included a lengthy question and answer period. The questions and King's answers are reprinted in the book. The Ballad of the Flexible Bullet. This is a reprint of a short story that first appeared in the June 1984 issue of The Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction and then reprinted in Skeleton Crew. How It Happened. This is an essay discussing the genesis of King's epic novel, It. It first appeared in the October 1986 edition of Book of the Month Club News. This is a very engaging essay about the genesis of It, but also about the creative process. King talks about the moment the idea came to him. The idea was so good it was horrible. It was also irresistible. He said he decided in the summer of 1981 that It had to be written. King cites the fairy tale The Three Billy Goats Gruff and The Hobbit as inspirations and influences on the overall notion of the novel. In this essay, King talks about the Stratford, Connecticut Public Library and the corridor connecting the adult and children's sections, reimagining the hallway as a bridge, and how suddenly the book came into being in his imagination and writer's consciousness. I know the Stratford Library well and have spoken there, and can easily see how that corridor can serve as an imaginary bridge to the past, which is exactly the metaphor King employed while writing It. King is incredibly self-effacing in this essay, saying that he was disconcerted when he realized that It was a major novel that could suggest metaphors and a theme. Regarding the idea of the bridge, he wrote, "In this second idea, I sensed something worse than a symbol. I sensed a theme, and this made me nervous. I'm not a bright novelist, no Graham Greene or Paul Bowles. If I wrote a book with a conscious theme, I would end with a bunch of sound and fury. I'm a storyteller. My virtues are honesty, good intent, and the ability to entertain people of my own level of intellect." Banned Books and Other Concerns, the Virginia Beach Lecture. This talk took place at the Virginia Beach Public Library on September 22, 1986, the day after King's 39th birthday. The lecture was recorded and transcribed by George Beam, author of The Stephen King Companion. King again revisited his Truth Inside the Lie theme. "I think that the real truth of fiction is that fiction is the truth. Moral fiction is the truth inside the lie. And if you lie in your fiction, you are immoral and have no business writing at all." King talks about when Studs Terkel's book, Working, was temporarily banned from the Pittsburgh school system due to complaints by a few parents about the language. The punchline to King's story is that when the kid whose mother started complaining originally took the book out, he was the first student to check it out in 3 years. When the school board banned the book, there were 63 stamps in the book. In this talk, King addresses the fact that some of his books have been banned in schools, specifically mentioning Cujo, Salem's Lot, and The Shining. This was when he gave some of his most well-known and repeated advice to students. "I would just say to you, as students who are supposed to be learning, that as soon as the book is gone from the library, do not walk, run to your nearest public library or bookseller and find out what your elders don't want you to know, because that's what you need to know. Don't let them bullshit you and don't let them guide your mind, because once it starts, it never stops. Some of our more famous leaders have been book banners, like Hitler, Stalin, Idi Amin." Turning the Thumbscrew on the Reader. This essay was first published in the June 1987 issue of Book of the Month Club News. In this essay, King talks about writing misery and then veers off into writing about writing. King uses the opportunity of this essay to tell one of the greatest stories ever told about James Joyce. Joyce was agonizing over the fact that he had written 7 words that day, but didn't know in what order they should appear. King also makes a statement with which many of us would disagree. "I don't have the ability to write the dazzling prose line. Horse hockey. What about these I've previously mentioned? Sooner or later, life takes in its breath, pauses, and then tilts towards winter. Leaf peepers." Or this passage from The Regulators. "And surrounding everything like an auditory edging of lace, the soothing, silky hiss of lawn sprinklers. Ever et raw meat? And other weird questions." This essay was first published in the December 6, 1987 edition of the New York Times Book Review. King talks about the questions fans ask him. He organizes them by category. The one-of-a-kind questions. These include, "I see you have a beard. Are you morbid of razors? Will you soon write of pimples or some other facial blemish? Why do you keep up this disgusting mother worship when anyone with any sense knows a man has no use to his mother once he is weaned? And ever at raw meat?" The old standards. These include, "Where do you get your ideas?" King says he gets his in Utica. "How do you get an agent?" King's answer is, "Sell your soul to the devil." "Do you have to know somebody to get published?" King responds, "Yes. In fact, it helps to grovel, toady, and be willing to perform twisted acts of sexual depravity at a moment's notice, and in public if necessary." "How do you start a novel?" King explains, "I usually start by writing the number one in the upper right-hand corner of a clean sheet of paper." The real weirdies. These include, "You writing any good books lately? Don't you wish you had a rubber stamp? And how come you're not reading one of your own books?" His answer to this one is, "I know how they all come out." A new introduction to John Foles's The Collector. This introduction was first published as a 12-page booklet distributed with the 1989 Book of the Month Club edition of The Collector by John Foles. What Stephen King Does for Love. This essay was first published in the April 1990 issue of 17 Magazine. What does Stephen King do for love? He reads. This is one of the more important nonfiction essays Stephen King has ever written. In this revealing essay, King discusses at length the influences on his writing, his resistance to reading what was assigned him in school, and the differences between reading for love and reading because you're told to, which is a paradigm King describes as consisting of two continents called wanna read and gotta read. This essay was out of print until Stephen King himself reprinted it in his 2000 collection, Secret Windows, which contained essays and short stories having to do with writing. Secret Windows was published by the Book of the Month Club as a companion volume to King's On Writing. In this excerpt, King talks about Charles Dickens. "I remember putting down A Tale of Two Cities and asking myself if this could really be the same man who had written the Pickwick Papers. It hardly seemed possible. Pickwick had been awful. Cities was wonderful. So, I discovered, was Oliver Twist. And if Hamlet is the greatest play ever written, then Great Expectations may be the greatest novel. And if you think I'm kidding, try it. I defy you not to finish it after reading the first 50 pages. That sucker kicks." These are the writers King mentions in the essay. Herman Melville, Danielle Steele, Dean Koontz, William Shakespeare, George Eliot, Emily Dickinson, John D. MacDonald, Ed McBain, Shirley Jackson, J.R.R. Tolkien, Reginald Rose, Tad Mosel, Rod Serling, Charles Dickens, Wilkie Collins, Ken Kesey, Tom Wolfe, Robert Howard, Andre Norton, Jack London, Margaret Mitchell, Agatha Christie, Margaret Miller, Joseph Heller, Thomas Hardy, Theodore Dreiser, Frank Norris, Edgar Allan Poe, Robert Frost, Ernest Hemingway, John Updike, James Fenimore Cooper, John Steinbeck, and himself. What Stephen King does for love is Stephen King at his most engaging. It is Stephen King as teacher. Reading this essay brought to mind something that Clive Barker, King's contemporary and fellow horror writer, once said about reading. "I forbid my mind nothing." Making the same point that King has often made about censorship and forbidding kids to read certain works. King has often advised kids to go to the public library or bookstore and read what their parents and teachers most definitely do not want them to read, including some of his own books. 2 Past Midnight, A Note on Secret Windows, Secret Garden. This essay first appeared in 4 Past Midnight in 1990. Introduction to Jack Ketchum's The Girl Next Door. This essay was written for and first appeared in the 1995 Overlook Connection Press edition of The Girl Next Door by Jack Ketchum. King is a big fan of Jack Ketchum, which is the widely known pseudonym of the late Dallas mayor. And in this essay, he puts Ketchum's work, particularly The Girl Next Door, in context as one of the great suspense novels of all time. He'll make you want to read it if you haven't already. Great Hookers I've Known. This essay, written when Joe Hill was 13 and Owen King was 10, is about opening lines, hookers, in fiction. King opines that, of his kids, he thinks Joe would probably be the one to make a living at writing. Of course, we know now that both Joe and Owen are full-time professional writers. King mentions a great hooker Joe came up with for a story. God owes me $100. At the time he wrote this essay, King said his favorite hooker from his own work was the opening line of Salem's Lot. Everybody thought the man and the boy were father and son. This essay is worth tracking down, if only for the list of great opening lines King provides. He says he ruled out Elmore Leonard from consideration, or else he would have taken up the entire list. A Night at the Royal Festival Hall, Muriel Gray interviews Stephen King, 1998. This is an interesting interview done with King at his most forthcoming when Bag of Bones was released. At one point, he uses his It dedication, "Fiction is the truth inside the lie," in an answer. King discusses his macular degeneration in this interview and essentially says he's okay and hopes for the best. The audience was brought down a notch when he was asked about it, but he broke the tension by saying, "I bought a dog. That's a classic Kingism. What if you go blind? I'll have a seeing eye dog." King mentions Peter Straub's comment that Stephen hasn't discovered sex when asked about the explicit sex in Bag of Bones and explains that he has discovered it, but never really had anything to say about it until that book. King admits that he would write for free, but encourages the audience to buy his book because he has a kid in college, other kids who need things, and that his wife has a bunch of relatives. King usually isn't so blunt about money in interviews. In this interview, King states unequivocally that he believes in an afterlife. He uses the analogy of a paper cup and an expensive crystal wine goblet. He believes human beings are akin to the goblet, and that we wouldn't throw away an expensive glass after one use. "We're not Dixie cups," he says. An Evening with Stephen King, 1999. This is a transcript of a talk King did at the University of Vermont. He was invited by Dr. Tony Magistrale. In this talk, King muses about a short story he never wrote, or at least never published, he may have written it, called Beauty Becomes You. It's about a hairdresser who does the hair of the dead. This talk includes one of my all-time favorite King quotes. I did make some notes, and I'm going to say a few things. But before I do that, I just want to remind you we're all having a fairly good time now for people who will die someday. Tony Magistrale remembers Stephen King's visit to the University of Vermont. Stephen and I played a game of tennis together after his talk, and I asked him if he wanted to take a sauna before being driven back to his hotel. He looked at me and said, "Where I come from, there are no saunas." Another time, Stephen and I were walking back from dinner at a downtown Burlington, Vermont restaurant. They had been kind enough to close their doors for the night to accommodate my 20 students enrolled in the King seminar. Strangely enough, the waitstaff all wanted to work that particular night. After dinner, around midnight, King and I were walking back to my car. It was a dark and spooky March night, as I recall, and we came upon a deserted building that had large pieces of plywood around its perimeters. One piece had a hole in it about the size of a head at shoulder height. King said to me, "Tony, I dare you to put your hand in there." I responded with, "Let's review. There is no one on the streets, and it's midnight. No moon, full dark, and I'm walking alone with Stephen King. No, you put your hand in there." King's reply was, "Not on your life." King admits to having a touch of obsessive-compulsive disorder and admits that sometimes he checks the stove 17, 18 times before going to bed. In this talk, King talks about having just written the short story 1408. He recounts that room 1402 of the Park Lane Hotel in New York City inspired the story after he stayed there and learned from the bellboy that the room he was in was where the actor Gig Young had committed suicide in the closet. The truth is that the bellboy, who King described as the world's oldest, was mistaken. 3 weeks after Gig Young's wedding in 1978, Gig Young shot his new wife Kim Schmidt and then killed himself in their condo apartment in the Osborne Apartments on West 57th Street in New York. At one point, King says, "Do I believe the Red Sox will ever win the World Series? Not in my lifetime. That's not going to happen." 5 years later, in 2004, the Red Sox won the World Series, and that year, King published a book about the team's winning season, co-written with Stuart Onan, called Faithful. In the Death Room. This is the first text appearance of a story that first appeared in the 1999 Blood and Smoke audiobook. On Writing, A Memoir of the Craft, October 2000. On Writing is part writing tutorial and part autobiography. It is widely considered one of the best writing books ever published. One of my English department colleagues at the University of New Haven assigns On Writing to his composition students every semester. On Writing is in several parts. First forward, second forward, third forward, CV, what writing is, toolbox, on writing, on living, a postscript. Faithful, 2004. This book was co-written with Stuart Onan and is about the Boston Red Sox 2004 season in which they won the World Series. On May 4th, 2007, the Boston Herald announced that HBO would be developing a 6-part miniseries based on the book for airing in 2008. King was quoted as saying, "The script is just goddamn hilarious." As of this writing, this miniseries has not aired. What Ails the Short Story, The New York Times, 2007. This essay first appeared in The New York Times on September 30th, 2007, and begins, "The American short story is alive and well," but he continues, "Do you like the sound of that? Me too. I only wish it were actually true." In this essay, King talks about his experience editing The Best American Short Stories, 2007. King concludes with, "So, American short story alive? Check. American short story well? Sorry, no, can't say so. Current condition stable, but apt to deteriorate in the years ahead." Raymond Carver's Life and Stories, The New York Times, 2009. This is King's review of the biography Raymond Carver, A Writer's Life by Carol Sklenica and the Library of America edition of Raymond Carver Collected Stories, edited by William L. Stull and Maureen P. Carroll. I have the Library of America edition King reviews, and it is a great collection of brilliant writing by a legendary American icon. King is a Carver fan. Stephen King's Letter to His Younger Self, 2010. This one is self-explanatory. Stephen King, Bangor, Maine, 04401, June 2010. Dear me, I'm writing to you from the year 2010, when I have reached the totally ridiculous age of 62, in order to give you a piece of advice. It's simple, really, just five words. Stay away from recreational drugs. You've got a lot of talent, and you're going to make lots of people happy with your stories, but, unfortunate but true, you are also a junkie waiting to happen. If you don't heed this letter and change the future, at least 10 good years of your life, from age 30 to 40, are going to be a kind of dark eclipse where you disappoint a lot of people and fail to enjoy your own success. You will also come close to dying on several occasions. Do yourself a favor and enjoy a brighter, more productive world. Remember that, like love, resistance to temptation makes the heart grow stronger. Stay clean. Best regards, Stephen King. Guns, 2013. This long, important essay was written by King after the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting on December 14, 2012, in Newtown, Connecticut. Guns has seven parts. 1. The Shake, a 21-part deconstruction of how America responds to a mass shooting. 2. Rage, the story of his Richard Bachman novel and why he decided to pull it from publication. 3. Drunks in a Barroom, a contemplation on the state of political discourse in America. 4. Culture of Violence, King's contention that there is no culture of violence in America and that it is a fiction created by the right-wing gun advocates, politicians, and the NRA. 5. From My Cold Dead Hands, musing on guns and the people who own them. 6. No Solutions, Reasonable Measures, King's three-part solution. 7. Epilogue, King tells of the most recent, at the time, mass shooting. King on the state of political discourse in America. Political discourse, as it once existed in America, has given way to useless screaming. We're like drunks in a barroom. No one's listening because everyone is too busy thinking about what they're going to say next, and absolutely prove that the current speaker is so full of shit he squeaks. King offers a trio of reasonable measures to curb gun violence. He lists them in order of likelihood. 1. Comprehensive and universal background checks. 2. Ban the sale of clips and magazines containing more than 10 rounds. 3. Ban the sale of assault weapons such as the Bushmaster and the AR-15. Just a Little Talent. This is an essay that appeared in the collection Hard Listening, The Greatest Rock Band Ever of Authors, Tells All, which was published exclusively as an ebook in 2013. The title comes from a quote from King's mother. "Almost everybody has one thing they're really good at. If you got just a little talent for something else, be grateful." In this essay, King talks about music, opening with the day his friend Charles Chesley called him to come over and listen to the new Dave Van Ronk album he had gotten for his birthday. They learned the song Bedbug Blues from the record, and that was sort of the beginning of King's second career as a rock musician. He also talks about his early guitars, playing with the remainders, and Dave Barry teaching him how to play bar chords. Hearts in Suspension, 2016. Hearts in Suspension is a collection of essays published by the University of Maine Press to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Stephen King's admission to the University of Maine. The book includes a new nonfiction essay by King called 5-1, 1-5, in which, according to the dust jacket, King sheds his fictional persona and takes on the challenge of a nonfiction return to his undergraduate experience. Hearts in Suspension also includes an introduction by Jim Bishop, King's English professor at UMO, and essays by 12 fellow students and friends from King's college days, including works by Harold Crosby, David Bright, Diane McPherson, Jim H. Smith, Philip Thompson, Keith Carrero, Sherry D., Bruce Hulsapple, Larry Moskowitz, Frank Cotty, Michael Alpert, and Jim Bishop, in addition to his introduction. The book also includes a reprint of King's novella Hearts in Atlantis with a new 2016 introduction, four reprints of original King's garbage truck columns, specifically May 15th, 1969, July 11th, 1969, and May 7th, 1970, and May 21st, 1970. See the section on King's garbage truck in this volume for word counts and first lines of these four columns. 5 to 1, 1 in 5. For me, remembering college is like taking a bite of cotton candy. It fills the mouth but melts almost at once, leaving just a lingering taste of sweetness behind. Stephen King. King wrote this essay especially for Hearts in Suspension. It runs from page 23 through page 76 in the book, totaling 53 pages. One of the reasons I'm a big fan of Stephen King's nonfiction is exemplified by this essay. It reads like fiction, and King is able to elicit true engagement with the work through his recognizable, accessible, and entertaining writer's voice. This is an important essay, which I will attempt to thematically deconstruct. No, I won't use the current trendy abomination, unpack. And it includes a reprint of the complete text of King's seminal poem, The Dark Man. See the essay on The Dark Man by Dr. Michael Collings in this volume. In the introduction to this essay, King cites his fiction is the truth inside the lie mantra to explain how most of the stories that follow are mostly true. In the first section of this essay, King posits an idea about near-death experiences, triggered by a memory from college in which he just missed getting killed in a 1969 car crash. He asks, if sometimes we see our past life flash before our eyes just before death, as some say, isn't it possible that some people might see their future life in the same way, moments before they get their face ripped off in a car slamming into a tree at a very high speed? Interesting idea. King, of course, muses that he would have seen his life as a husband, father, teacher, writer, and so forth if he had been in the car that he had only moments before exited. King then talks about taking a tour of the University of Maine and explains in detail just how poor his mother and he and his brother David were during his high school years. How poor? At one point, they had an outhouse. That's how poor. King relates showing up for his draft-mandated military physical egregiously hungover and tripping on purple microdot acid. He was rejected for bad eyes and high blood pressure, which he admits did not surprise him considering the condition he was in at the time. The next section of this essay is about rage. No, not the novel, although that does make an appearance, albeit brief, but King's personal sense of rage during his college years. He writes that looking back now at his college-era writings, he can see the anger, the furious disenchantment that he now considers revelatory. It took me years to look back on those early stories and poems and realize how angry I was, how fucking furious, through most of the time I spent at the University of Maine. In today's society, one of my stories, Cain Rose Up, would have put me under scrutiny as a possible school shooter. King admits that he may have been overreacting considering his actual empirical circumstances. I wasn't going hungry. I was no Oliver Twist asking for a second helping. I had friends. I had a sex life of sorts. Yet the rage was there, a steady stream of magma that came out only in the fiction I was writing. King concludes his discussion of his college rage with this assessment of his poem, The Dark Man, and a self-aware conclusion. It's only now, looking at this poem after many years, that I can see past the juvenile romanticism and the influences, Walt Whitman, Gerard Manley Hopkins, Ray Bradbury, LSD, The Doors, even the film Hush Hush Sweet Charlotte, to what may have been the wellspring of that rage. I felt like an outsider. I felt alone. And that was okay, because the anger was fuel. Besides, I liked the darkness. I felt at home there. King then talks about his college roommate Harold Crosby, a young man who was as straight-laced and serious as King was not. Harold wanted to become a dentist, and today he is a dentist. He also has an essay in Hearts in Suspension in which he remembers King's typewriter going all the time and muses that one of the biggest regrets is not asking King to sign and give him one of the typed stories he'd asked him to read. King then also discusses his, at the time, republicanism and says he is now a liberal Democrat who most assuredly rejects the Republican operating principle of, good luck, buddy, you're on your own. King talks about voting for Richard Nixon in 1968. About reading In Dubious Battle and The Grapes of Wrath, and about spending 4 hours picketing a grocery store in Bangor on behalf of the United Farm Workers who went on strike against grape growers in California to fight for a minimum wage. Interestingly, King makes mention of his cognitive dissonance regarding his picketing. I did not see the dichotomy between my support of the UFW and my Republican beliefs, which included the freedom to pay your workers whatever you could get away with. He concludes this section with the statement, "Fiction has the power to change lives." In the next section, King talks about Vietnam, napalm, and moving into a cabin in University Cabins, a group of cabins that housed 4 students each and which were arranged in a circle, like a wagon train preparing to withstand an Indian attack. King reveals he had reached a point where he believed that killing the Vietnamese ostensibly for peace was insane. He remembers a poster that appeared in the UMO Memorial Union. "Killing for peace is like fucking for chastity," that was quickly taken down. King moves on to talk about protests on campus and the taking of his iconic study damn it photo. He was hungover. He states that he believes he looks totally insane in the picture and that he's got a Charlie Manson vibe going on. He says the picture captures the angry, unquiet spirit of a man who would eventually go on to create Annie Wilkes and Pennywise the Clown. Yep. King also talks about being a member of the Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, and relates the story of a protest in which he was involved, known as the Chicken Crisis. The protest consisted of bringing three live chickens, named Humphrey, Nixon, and Wallace, into the UMO Union, and just letting them hang out. The protesters and the chickens were eventually evicted and cooked and eaten. The chickens, that is. Come on, who doesn't like a little dangling modifier joke now and then? A tweet from Stephen King. Satan to Manson.
Yo, Charlie, what took you so long, Broheim? Have a seat by the fire, and let me stick this red-hot poker up your butt.
In the next section, King talks about tragic events that took place between 1968 and 1970, a time that gave us the assassinations of Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and student protesters at Kent State. King talks about taking a teaching job at Hampton Academy and the personal psychological battle he waged wondering if, by complying with his new job's no long hair requirement, he'd be surrendering to the man. He decided a paying job was more important than a ponytail. It reads like a short story. The next section is about King's early years as a teacher, an occupation he accepted rather than sought out. He was married and had a kid, after all, so he taught high school and considered teaching elementary school. He felt he could teach Frost to fifth graders, and many of them might get it. However, the big problem for writers with teaching is that it drains the energy out of you. I can attest to this firsthand. King uses the metaphor of the teacher connecting jumper cables from his or her head to the students' heads and draining out all the creative juice. So, he took a job at a laundry, the New Franklin Laundry, a decision which resulted in a few really good short stories. This freed up his mind to write. No papers to grade, no lesson plans to fill out. King then talks about the five English teachers who influenced him, naming specifically Merton Ricker, Jim Bishop, Burton Hatlin, Ted Holmes, and Graham Adams. All writers have a list like this. Mine are John Shreed, Notre Dame High School, Dick Allen, University of Bridgeport, and Jay Halpern, University of New Haven. My literary agent, John White, also a writer, also had a big influence on me, but I never had him as a teacher. In the next section, King recounts working in a textile mill on the 3 to 11 o'clock shift after high school classes in the spring and summer before college. He was offered the opportunity to work over the 4th of July holiday cleaning out the basement, but took the week off without pay due to exhaustion and slept most of that week. Later, a co-worker told him there had been rats the size of cats down there, and thus, King's story Graveyard Shift was born. He sold it to Cavalier for $200. King then spends time discussing alcohol abuse, specifically his own. An alcoholic can no more choose not to drink than a man with diarrhea can choose not to shit, he proclaims, and tells the story of the two times he got arrested for being drunk. One, he got off, claiming he was only drunk walking, but the second time he was convicted of petty larceny and fined $500 because, while drunk, he drove around Orono and stole 40 or more traffic cones. He felt they were a hazard. He moves on to his early experiences with cocaine and his first few acid and mescaline trips. He also talks about not liking the high of pot, calling it dope for dopes. In the next section, King reminisces about the fall semester of his junior year. What's interesting to students and followers of King's work is what he has to say about specific titles. At the time he was writing Sword in the Darkness, a novel he felt was as good as Ross Lockbridge's Rain Tree County, and which he realized wasn't and is now grateful it was never published. He admits that he has written some novels that aren't very good. A footnote connected to this claim reads, The Tommyknockers comes to mind. He then talks about being persuaded by Dino De Laurentiis to direct Maximum Overdrive, his film version of his short story, Trucks. In another footnote, he writes that Maximum Overdrive was filmed with a crew that spoke only Italian. I will never live that down. King concludes the essay with remembrances of his graduation and his final thoughts about entering the real world. He admits sneering with his friend Flip at what the real world might involve for them. Checked golf pants, pot bellies, ranch-style homes in the suburbs with attached two-car garages, 2.5 kitties, and barbecues on Sunday afternoon. He then acknowledges being shamed by a friend named Karen, who, with a troubled smile, admitted to them that her parents had had barbecues on Saturday afternoons when she was growing up, telling them, "We had fun. I don't hate my parents for having those Saturday afternoon barbecues. I love them for it." King's last thought is that Karen's rebuke may have been a reminder that even when Atlantis sinks, it's possible to swim away.